Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We are your hosts, Matt Levine.
And Vincent Hannum.
We're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts, with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com. Hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, stay campy, everybody. Vincent, I'm excited to talk to you about the movie Wolf from 1994.
And I am excited to talk to you about Wolf from 1994. Holy cats and dogs, this movie.
Yeah, it's a weird movie. Like it's a weird mix of like kind of a prestige horror movie, but it is also like kind of dumb and silly and campy in spots. I don't really know exactly what they're trying to do with this movie, like who it's meant for. And it just seems like such a weird relic of the mid-90s that like most people have totally forgotten by now. Maybe, you know, for better or worse. I'll just leave it at that for now.
I just want to say I think I know now why I've never heard of this movie.
Yeah, I think it was kind of a big deal in 1994 because I remember when I was 10 years old and it came out, I was aware of it and like thought that it seemed cool, like a werewolf movie, you know, but I did not see it back then. I waited whatever, how long ago was that? 29 years. And I don't know if it was worth the wait, but we'll get into it. We'll talk about it.
Yeah. Okay.
So to all of you out there, thank you for hanging out and listening. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. We would really appreciate that. On our website, you'll have access to more reviews. Vincent and I kind of dig a little bit more in depth into some of the movies that we talk about in the podcast and many movies that we don't talk about in the podcast. For all of our patrons out there, you'll get special bonus content. It's well worth it. Thanks to all of our patrons out there, Jason, Chris, Frank, Kelly, Peggy, and our mystery patron. All right, got to limber up here real quick. Got my mallet in hand, my gong mallet in hand. I'm winding up.
I don't even know what I just saw. Flashes of light.
It was a glorious moment. What a beautiful tintinnabulation that was. I think that's the correct usage of that word. Yeah, the Gamera Gong, as amazing as we expect it to be every single time. And that, again, is in honor of our patrons. So thank you again to all of our patrons out there. Yeah, check it out if you're not yet a patron.
Patreon.com/CampKaiju, or you can visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com, where you'll find links to the Patreon, as well as past episodes of this podcast, as well as those written reviews that Matt and I are churning out weekly.
Yeah, so Vincent, what is coming up on Camp Kaiju, the podcast?
Well, coming up on Camp Kaiju, the podcast, we have three more films to round out our first 6 months here of season three. We have Godzilla versus King Ghidorah coming up next, followed by The Blob, 1958 classic, and Porco Rosso, the Miyazaki film, one of his earlier ones. Is that correct?
That is correct. I'm sure it's relatively early. I'm trying to remember when it's from, like early 80s, I think.
Michael Keaton voices Porco Rosso.
Oh, it's actually 1992. So that's maybe more like mid-period Miyazaki, but still I'm very excited to see it.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, very excited for that. I'm excited for the original The Blob. I've seen the remake more recently than the original, so it'll be good to go back to that one.
Yeah, and we may have special guests for those movies.
Yes, indeed. We may. maybe The Blob itself will join us in the podcast. That would be awesome. You wouldn't really be able to hear anything except for a lot of gelatinous squelching, but we'll still try to make it happen. Who knows?
I think you've just given us our next bit. The Blob, guest hosting on Camp Kaiju. Stay tuned. I mean, the Blob, he's not much of a talker, but he squishes with the best of them. So you're not going to want to miss this one, folks. I think Gary Dansu may actually join us for that one. And Frank, good old Frank Olson, will join us for Porco Rosso to close out the first half of season three, when we will announce what we got lined up for July through probably December. So yeah, Matt, we haven't talked about that but pretty solid classic and maybe not so classic monster movies on the docket.
Yeah, I can't wait. We haven't really talked about it, but I have been thinking about it. And yeah, I'm sure there will be a lot of great stuff in the second half of 2023.
Mm-hmm.
So we already kind of talked about personal histories with the movie Wolf. Anything else, any other things that you want to bring up, like, you know, before we get into it?
No, I just I rented it on Amazon Prime last Friday night, and you know, that was it. I spent money on this movie and I don't even get to keep it.
Probably only like $3 though, right?
Yeah, it was fine.
Was it? Hopefully it was worth $3 at least. I would say it is.
But it was worth $3.
Although I can't really talk because I borrowed an international Blu-ray from a friend of mine who likes this movie quite a bit. Michael, if you're listening to the podcast, first of all, I hope he joins us someday. He's expressed interest. He's very, very smart about movies, so that'd be great. But he's a big fan of Wolf, and he lent me his Blu-ray, which he probably spent, you know, upwards of $20 on to like buy the Blu-ray and to like get it shipped to the United States. So at least you didn't spend that much money, Vincent.
Well, that just reminds me, when I was maybe 12 or so, the Ben Affleck Daredevil had come out. And I was really into superheroes then, as I am now. And I bought that on DVD, a two-disc DVD for $20. And that was not a good investment.
I would imagine. I still have not seen that movie. And I kind of hope I keep that going for the rest of my life.
No more than $3. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. For $3, maybe I would. Yeah, well, a little bit of a tangent. That reminds me of one time I was really, really young and my parents gave me some money to like go to the store and buy something. I think it was like something they needed at home, like a cleaning supply or something like that, like that they actually needed. So I went to Shopko or whatever it was, and I saw like the X-Files VHS box set of like, it must have been season 3 or something like that. Mm. And I used their money to buy the X-Files instead of what they sent me to the store to buy. It was really mad when I got home. So that's my story. Totally unrelated. Not really necessary.
Just like a whole podcast about the youths of movie lovers and like what we were really into and spent too much money on.
Yeah, making irresponsible decisions all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I still do, buying movies instead of, you know, paying student loans or bills or anything like that. But that's the way I like it, you know?
Yeah, that's the way it should be.
Well, should we dive into the story of Wolf?
Let's.
All right. So, while driving in Vermont, book editor Will Randall is bitten by a black wolf. The timing for Will is not great, since the publishing company that he works for is in the midst of a corporate overhaul. Will is soon demoted from his editor-in-chief position, and he's replaced by his slimy colleague, Stuart, who it soon becomes clear is also sleeping with Will's wife, Charlotte.
Despite these personal and professional humiliations, Will becomes more confident and aggressive, apparently a result of his wolf bite. At a party hosted by the publishing company's new CEO, Raymond Alden, Will meets Alden's daughter, Laura, and they begin a tenuous relationship. Will also starts a new publishing company and begins poaching his former company's writers until Will is offered his old job back, allowing him to get a measure of revenge on Stuart by firing him and, well, urinating on his shoes in the bathroom.
Marking his territory, as he says.
Yeah.
While staying at the Alden's guest house with Laura, Will transforms into a werewolf one night and kills a deer that evening. The next day, he wakes up with no recollection of what happened. He then meets mythology expert Dr. Vishav Alizeas, who informs Will about werewolf legends. That night, once again, Will transforms into a werewolf, killing three muggers in a park, and waking up the next day with, once again, no memory of what happened.
Scared of what he has become, Will chains himself to a radiator in a hotel room. But Laura shows up and tries to convince him he's not actually a werewolf. However, a detective arrives to inform both of them that Will's wife, Charlotte, has been killed and canine DNA has been found on the body. At the police station, Laura encounters Stuart, who has been turned into a werewolf after Will bit him on the hand. Laura flees the police station and returns home, but Stuart follows her there.
Will, who has locked himself in a cage so he can't kill any more people, witnesses Stuart, as a werewolf, attack Laura. Will removes his protective amulet so he can transform once again and attack Stuart. The two wolves have a climactic showdown, and the ending leaves it ambiguous who exactly has been transformed into a werewolf and what the characters' relationships might be going forward.
And those two characters are Will and Laura. Laura now presenting as a werewolf herself.
Yeah, which is not very logical. Like, it's unclear how that happens. Like, is it just, like, in the act of lovemaking that Laura is turned into a wolf? Does Will bite her at some point? Maybe Stuart does. Logic is not this movie's strong suit. Who knows?
Oh, we're just getting the tip of the iceberg here.
Yeah, indeed.
Spoiler alert, things happen throughout this movie with no explanation or no rhyme or reason. It just happens. And you're like, oh, okay, I'm sure. I'll go along with that one.
Yeah, usually I like to think that I bring a lot of suspension of disbelief to a movie like this, like any kind of horror, like horror, action, sci-fi movie, anything like that. But this movie, strains credulousness for sure.
Well, that's like, as a writer, that it's so fascinating for me to watch a movie like this. Because you're right, why does this fantasy film make no sense? But Godzilla versus King Ghidorah, well, maybe that's not a good example. let's just say Bram Stoker's Dracula, similar time. And that movie, why is that story so much more credible than Wolf's story when they're both about supernatural monsters? It's because, in a nutshell, Wolf doesn't establish any rules. It's made up, it's fantasy, but it still has to have rules to play by. And it plays fast and loose with its own rule book. So you're just like, well, there's no anchor here.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And even the scene with Dr. Alizeus, which is supposed to be all exposition where we find out about the rules, like, doesn't really make very much sense. And it's just like vague themes about like virility and aging and death and stuff like that. So yeah, we never get a good idea of like what universe we're in here, you know?
Yep. And yeah, okay, when we get to the themes, there's a whole lot of nothing, but we'll get to it. Okay, cast and crew. So leading this fine furry film is Jack Nicholson. He plays Will Randall. Now, Nicholson had tried to get the movie made for 12 years along with his friend and screenwriter and associate producer Jim Harrison. Michelle Pfeiffer is his co-star. She plays Laura Alden. This role was initially offered to Sharon Stone, but she turned it down. And rounding out our big three of the cast is James Spader as Stuart Swinton. Spader had appeared in Stargate the same year and David Cronenberg's Crash 2 years later.
He was in full-on, like, you know, perverse freak weirdo phase at this point in his career, which he does very well. He's great at that.
Yeah, he's a force to be reckoned with in this film.
Kate Nelligan is Charlotte, which is Will's wife. Mia Farrow was originally in the running for the role, but she was deemed too controversial. The Woody Allen Suni Previn scandal was going on at the time, so Mia Farrow was not able to play the role. They went with Kate Nelligan instead. The film also stars Christopher Plummer, rest in peace, as Raymond Alden. Richard Jenkins, who I was surprised to see in this movie, as the detective. He has a very short and thankless role. Indian actor Om Puri as Dr. Vijav Alizeus, an even more thankless role. And finally, David Hyde Pierce in a very small role as Will's assistant. So a very good cast in this movie.
Top-notch cast, top-notch director, writing team.
Yeah, so Mike Nichols, you know, a very acclaimed film, theater, and television director. A lot of very impressive credits on his resume. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was his first feature film. He also directed The Graduate, Catch 22, Carnal Knowledge, Working Girl, The Birdcage, Primary Colors, many, many others. So a long and very successful career.
Yeah, and I just want to say, Mike Nichols, also a legend director of the stage. My first two plays I ever saw in New York, Clifford Odets' The Country Girl, which was a revival from a 50s play, and Spamalot, both of those productions directed by Mike Nichols. He's an EGOT winner, so an acclaimed director of human beings and stories. And I credit the podcast Horror Queers, which had a great in-depth episode about Wolf. But in that, they reference Mike Nichols' own autobiography or biography, where he talks about his experience on Wolf. And he wanted to make this movie, but it quickly became apparent to himself and everyone involved, even Jack Nicholson, that Nichols was out of his element with the genre. He didn't know how to direct horror movies. He didn't know how to direct action movies, because all those ones you just said, I mean, for the most part, they're like intimate dramas, comedies, very, just like actors being actors, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, like I know Nichols and the screenwriter, Jim Harrison, who we just talked about, the co-screenwriter, definitely did not see eye to eye on this movie. We'll get into that more in a second. But yeah, like Nichols seemed to approach this project with, you know, a kind of restraint, I guess, even though like with the finished product, that seems like kind of a bad term for it. But like he did bring to it a kind of restraint that is maybe not ideal for the horror genre. So probably did not work out too well in the end.
Yeah, and he and Jack Nicholson had worked together, longtime friends and collaborators. Their relationship took a hit during this time. Again, crediting the same podcast, Horror Queers. Jack Nicholson was going through a breakup during this film. He was allergic to the spirit gum, the adhesive that is used to put on false hair for makeup effects. So like he just wasn't really having a great time himself. And apparently Jack Nicholson, when he's in a bad mood, it just affects everybody. And I can imagine that. I can imagine a cranky Jack Nicholson being someone I don't really like to be around.
Yeah. Not to mention, you know, he has kind of a like a notorious, like hard living lifestyle, like at parties until like 3 a.m. almost every night and like drinking with friends and stuff like that. So yeah, like I read, you know, he would get to the makeup room or whatever at a certain time and just like sleep while Rick Baker was like applying this makeup to him because he was hungover almost every day. And you know, if he's not enjoying the project, I'm sure that was even more exacerbated, you know?
Yep. Yep.
So already not a great kind of working environment on this project. Just a little bit more about the crew of the film, because it is extremely impressive, the talent that they have behind the camera as well. We talked a little bit about Jim Harrison, the co-screenwriter, along with Wesley Strick, the other credited screenwriter, who contributed to the screenplays for Arachnophobia, Batman Returns, the Cape Fear remake, Mission Impossible 2, which was an uncredited kind of screenplay cleanup type thing. So Wesley Strick has had a long writing career. Wolf also had uncredited rewrites by Elaine May, who was Mike Nichols' theater partner going back to the late 1950s through the early 1960s. They had a famous improv comedy duo, Nichols and May, award-winning improv act, and you know, continued to work together and collaborate on many different projects over the years. So I did not expect that Elaine May had anything to do with this movie, but apparently she did, and she's a fantastic writer and director. Again, very impressive talent behind the scenes on this movie.
Yep, 100%.
We also have the cinematographer Giuseppe Rotuno, who worked with such great Italian directors as Federico Fellini, Vittorio De Sica, and Luchino Visconti, including the film The Leopard, which is one of the most beautiful movies ever made. So Giuseppe Rotuno is nothing to mess around with behind the camera. He's a fantastic cinematographer. Speaking of some fantastic Italian crew members, we have a soundtrack by Ennio Morricone, who, you know, did several hundred soundtracks throughout his career. A lot of spaghetti westerns, such as Once Upon a Time in the West, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. A lot of work with Brian De Palma. Again, just a very esteemed film composer. And finally, as Vincent already alluded to, makeup effects by Rick Baker, which I was kind of surprised by because we don't really see a lot of makeup effects in this movie.
Right, which is confusing when you have arguably the most renowned makeup effects, special effects artist in the business, especially at this time. I mean, the 80s was his peak, and now it's the early 90s. Why not use the talent you've got?
Exactly, yeah. And maybe this connects to what you were talking about, where Nichols kind of like shied away from the horror genre a little bit. Because like with a werewolf movie, you want like the gruesome transformation scene, you know? Like that's one of the great things about a werewolf movie. And we never really get that here. So one of many disappointments, I would say.
With even, and this is something I, so it's just to get into it a little bit right now. I like, as a werewolf movie fan, you got two types of werewolf movies, right? You got a werewolf, The Howlings, your American Werewolves in London. Then you have Wolfman movies, like The Wolfman and this one. Wolf, I think, is a Wolfman movie, which I like. I like the different direction it takes, but I'm still missing that transformation. Gruesome or not, he's just kind of there. You know what I mean? He's like Jack Nicholson, who's already hairy, and then you blink and, oh, now you're a wolf. And it's such a slight change.
Yeah, like it's pretty much like the gold contact lenses that sets across, like sets apart the wolves in this movie. You know, we see that with James Spader and Michelle Pfeiffer towards the end as well.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like just lighter colored eyes is not really enough to like distinguish like a wolf person, you know?
And Nicholson never had those contacts, right?
I think you're right. I think maybe there's like one shot where it implies it, where he's like in the dark and we see his eyes glow a little bit, but we never really get like a close up of it, you know? That's good to know about Nichols' reluctance to kind of leap into this genre. I was not really aware of that. And it kind of makes sense, you know, given the behind the scenes conflict between Nichols and Jim Harrison, who wrote the script. He had written the script a long time ago and then served as co-screenwriter and associate producer on the film. According to Harrison, those two, he and Nichols, did not get along at all. They did not see eye to eye on this project. And Harrison said that he himself wanted kind of a what he referred to as a Dionysian vibe, meaning, you know, more chaos, passion, irrationality, pleasure, drunkenness, kind of like the fun things about a werewolf or a wolfman, right? Like losing your inhibitions. According to Harrison, Nichols wanted a more Apollonian vibe. I tried to do a little research about this kind of ancient Greek rift between Dionysus and Apollo. But according to Harrison, the Apollo approach is kind of more logic, reason, poetry, art, justice, order, like restraint, prestige, things like that. Mm. Harrison has a really good quote where he said, Mike Nichols took my wolf and made it into a chihuahua. I cracked up for 10 minutes and then went out into the country and stood in front of a wolf den and apologized while my dog hid under the truck. So it's a weird way to put it, but Harrison is not mincing words. Like the finished version of Wolf is not at all what he envisioned when he was writing the screenplay.
And there are so many hands involved in the screenplay. And I think that that level of inconsistent tone bleeds through in the final product. Because like you alluded to in the beginning, there are long parts of this film where it plays like a prestige horror film or just like a straight up drama. And then it's interspersed with really awkward humor and one-liners. Even until the end, when it's like full-on horror, Richard Jenkins as the detective, who, you know, suddenly we have these like two dorky detectives who show up, and they've got like some one-liners that are like so bad they're good, but they don't belong really in the tone that's being established here, you know?
Right, yeah, like if it's trying to be sort of like a, you know, a witty satire of like the world of publishing and like corporate America, or if it's trying to be kind of like a, you know, horrific comment about like the animal inherent in men, like that's like this movie just like doesn't figure out what its vibe is, and like that is a kind of a constant flaw throughout the whole thing. But yeah, the experience was so bad for Jim Harrison that he left Hollywood, never really came back, never wrote another screenplay. He had a long career writing novels and novellas and stories after that, but Wolf convinced him to not make another Hollywood picture. Maybe the right decision. Who knows?
Bummer.
Yeah. Aside from that, production went on kind of without a hitch. Production took place in New York City and Long Island, as well as in Los Angeles. It was shot from April through July 1993, although the release was delayed by 8 months in order to do reshoots after the initial test ending was poorly received. Couldn't really get a lot of information about that. It sounds like the werewolf duel at the end was particularly kind of criticized by the test audiences, but I don't really know any more facts beyond that.
I don't either. I think that, probably unrelated to reshoots, but in terms of like a troubled production, I know the editing team had trouble with this film with the action sequences because Mike Nichols didn't shoot enough fight sequences or fight footage. So if you recall in the film, there's a lot of like slow motion effects laid on top of the fight scenes or any sort of action. That's the editor just trying to milk it for all it's worth because he didn't have material to go to.
Wow. I have to admit, I kind of like a lot of those slow motion moments. I think they lend a kind of uniqueness to the fight scenes when like otherwise there wouldn't really be anything to distinguish them. So, you know, it's an unfortunate context for sure, but some of it works okay, I think, in the final film.
I don't disagree, actually. I think it's something, it's a bit of flair for me in an otherwise pretty staid movie. But it wasn't done on purpose. Wow. It was done to cover up a mistake.
And that definitely speaks to what you were talking about, that Mike Nichols has so much prowess and skill and mastery in like drama and comedy, but these more spectacular genres, probably not. The movie was sort of well received for the most part. Janet Maslin in the New York Times said the movie works as long as it stays confined to the level of metaphor. Although she does admit that like as soon as the actual Wolfman shows up, then it's not quite as successful. Kind of on the other end of the spectrum, Roger Ebert wished for more vulgar thrills befitting a werewolf movie, but he did appreciate the production quality and Nicholson's performance. It showed up on a couple critics' end of the year best of lists, but at the same time had some very negative reviews as well. So
yeah,
generally kind of just like an indifferent response, I would say.
After my initial viewing, I did not hate this movie. There was a lot I don't necessarily enjoy, but maybe admire. But I am just in tune enough with writing and filmmaking and story that the mistakes, because they are just mistakes, are just really apparent. I also want to say that Wolf came out in the early 90s at the same time Bram Stoker's Dracula came out and Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein. So not that these respective films were Universal movies, because they weren't, but it was sort of like a soft resurgence of like the classic horror canon, which I find really interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I agree. And I wish more of them, or like, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula is my favorite of those three, because Francis Ford Coppola really leans into like the spectacular visuals and like the over-the-top bombast, like all the gore and everything. Like that movie is just like such a blast to watch. It's so fun. You know, Frankenstein, I think, has its moments, although it doesn't quite work. I think the changes from the original novel, although I don't think that that's like the best way to evaluate an adaptation, just like really don't work for the most part in that movie. Also, Kenneth Branagh is just way too much like patting himself on the back. Like there are so many like shirtless, oiled up scenes where he's like running around his laboratory and like trying to make himself into a sex symbol. It's a little obnoxious, I think. But, you know, yeah, it's a good point. And I think Wolf probably is the worst of those three. And again, I do think it's, you know, no disrespect to Nichols, but he probably was not the right person for this project.
Yeah. And that's really interesting to me, too, is it takes a certain eye and sensibility to know how to do it right.
Yeah, I think so. Like, you don't want to be just totally all guts and gore and like craziness all the time. But like, But yeah, if you're too restrained, if you're approaching it too timidly, then I think, you're not taking advantage of like the visceral aspects that like this genre horror does so well. So you're right, it's a fine balance for sure, but this movie does not do it very well.
Yeah, or even as just a thriller.
Yeah.
It doesn't really, it just kind of falls flat. Or a mystery. Like there's nothing, there are no hallmarks done well of any like of those riveting genres. Even as a drama, I'm a little salty about this movie. There's like nothing really for me to sink my teeth into.
Nice.
No pun intended with this movie.
I feel like this is a good time for me to say that there are some things that I like about this movie quite a bit. I agree that like the narrative does not work very well for the most part. And yeah, aesthetically there are some things that I could be done better, but on the other hand, this movie looks fantastic and there are some things that I really enjoy about it. So we'll get into that more in a moment here.
Please. Yeah, we should give credit where it's due at some point.
Yeah, exactly. But before we get into that, it's time to shout out BanditsEmporium.com, the official t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju. So once again, check out BanditsEmporium.com or hit the link in our bio to check out their selection of monster-inspired tees. Part of the proceeds go to supporting this very show, so Vincent could spend $3 to rent Wolf on Amazon. Visit BanditsEmporium.com, whatever your style, they have you covered. As they say, we sell shirts. As we say at Camp Kaiju, we'll see the Howling instead. That's what we say. The Howling is awesome, by the way. I love that movie. It's my favorite werewolf movie, so I had to work that in there somewhere.
No, I love The Howling. I would love to see the sequels, and we could do a thing where we could watch the sequels and see at what point it becomes worse than Wolf. At what sequel do we go, okay, actually Wolf is the preferred movie to watch.
We can make an infographic. I like it.
That's nice. I like that
Well,
too.
yeah, we'll get started on that for sure. All right, so jumping into the themes of the movie Wolf, is there anything that you want to start off with, Vincent?
Oh, my big takeaway, my big theme was just the midlife crisis. It's a midlife crisis movie. We have a white American male. Like his character is very meek, walked all over. His wife is cheating on him. The typical successful rich man, but also he's a doormat. And through the wolf, he's able to stand up for himself, have an affair with a young blonde woman, grow hair.
Yeah, I think that's, the theme in a nutshell. I think like placing it in the context of the publishing industry, because Will, is an editor at this publishing company, which is going through a lot of changes. It's kind of, from Will's perspective, less about the art of writing and like the writers that they have, that they represent, and more about money. So I think there's definitely an element of satire there. Will says at one point in a pretty ridiculous speech, like, nobody cares about art anymore. It's all about money. And then he like goes off the rails about like daytime TV and like gay seniors, he mentions at some point. Like he's really kind of a repugnant character. Even though like people say, oh, he's like a nice guy and he's refined and like mild-mannered and all that. I feel like this is a good time to point out, I read a review of Wolf, which I really, really loved. It's at the website Medium. It's written by Honoria Valamon. And she makes a very convincing case that Will is a misogynist, terrible person from the start, and that this movie is unintentionally, like the Mike Nichols and the screenwriters weren't setting out to do this in her estimation. But it's a satire of people who think that everybody should be concerned about their own midlife crisis when there are way more important things going on in the world around them. And we do kind of see that, his wife Charlotte talks about all the sexism that she faces as a journalist. And then Will just like immediately cuts her off, and like the movie kind of like switches back to focusing on him. There's also the really disturbing scene where Will kills three muggers of color in Central Park who are about to mug him. And then the next day, he doesn't remember what happened, but he finds two dismembered black fingers in his pocket. I don't like there's a weird like group of early to mid 90s movies that are set in New York that have white protagonists that are like seemingly blatantly racist, but also somehow don't seem to realize that. Like Bonfire of the Vanities from 1990 is another good example of that, although maybe the satire is a little bit more intentional in that case. So, you know, all these things where, you know, we're supposed to care about Will and his midlife crisis, but like on the periphery of the movie, we see way more important injustices happening to other people. You know, there's a nugget of like a more interesting movie there, but Wolf like doesn't go in that direction, you know?
A few points to that. So one thing that I like about the movie is that it introduces at the police precinct the mother of one of those muggers. And she talks about how if her son was white, it would have been solved by now. And she's just trying to find answers to her son's death. So I think that's great the way you put it. It's on the periphery, arguably more important things going on than this one man's midlife crisis. Also, I like, to your point about this movie being completely white, except for the criminals who are of color. That is just like a classic 90s thing that I feel like is in the conversation more these days. The memes and jokes about Friends, for instance. So white. But I've also been binging Frasier. Another classic 90s show, all white. I mean, Seinfeld, obviously, but the list goes on and on and on of shows and movies set in New York, all white, except for criminals or super minor characters. 90s so white.
Yeah. Hashtag 90s so white. Yeah, you're totally right. Like, it's, you know, like it's a fantasy of like this totally white urban area where like everybody's rich, everybody has power and privilege. And like, we're supposed to be concerned with like the fairly petty issues that they have going on in their lives, you know?
Yeah. I remember the last point I was going to make. So I like when Will finds the fingers in his pockets, to use your favorite word, it's very visceral. And it's like, oh, that's like a nice effect. Mm-hmm. But to your idea that he doesn't actually care about anyone else, he doesn't do anything. He just kind of, I don't even remember what he does with the fingers, but it's just like he has a moment of, oh God, what happened? And then he's moving on. And he is not interested in atoning for what he has done. And it's just very disingenuous. I don't, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think like it is shortly after that he like chains himself or handcuffs himself to the radiator in a hotel room. And then Laura shows up to like talk some sense into him, but that's not really, it doesn't exonerate him or anything like that. You know, like it seems like he's doing it more for Laura's sake than like shock of what he did to these people that he doesn't know. And you know, I think like the movie is implying that like, we're still supposed to empathize with this character because he's a white man who's desperate and he like killed, you know, like I think the movie is saying like, oh, they're criminals. It's okay. Like society won't miss them or whatever, you know, like everything about that scene just like comes off the wrong way and is disturbing for all the wrong reasons, you know?
Yep.
Just the last thing that I want to say about the themes in this movie, like I think it also gets at some stuff about like the animalism in man and sort of like if, you know, amorality, if kind of like loosening your ethical constraints can ever be like an admirable thing, you know, and kind of like not subscribing to what society says that you should do and sort of like reclaiming your vigor and your strength and stuff like that. I think the movie is sort of asking that question, but it sort of goes back to like the Dionysus thing that the screenwriter Jim Harrison was talking about. But also, I don't think that's especially interesting because like so many werewolf or wolfman movies have done that. And I know that this is not necessarily a werewolf movie, but Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the 1931 film with Frederick March, which does have kind of like a werewolf vibe because Mr. Hyde suddenly becomes like darker skinned and very hairy when he sort of turns into his like more virile self or whatever. And, you know, that movie was asking that question like 63 years before Wolf came out. So I do think that there are some themes on this movie's mind, but you know, they're so familiar already. They're like part of the werewolf mythology. And this movie doesn't really do anything to complexify that, you know?
Yeah, well put.
So yeah, thematically, not a lot going on here.
Geez, what was I going to say? Apparently, I'm not saying the movie is an AIDS metaphor, but some on the production did cite it as an AIDS metaphor. And I think the opening of the film even donated its proceeds to AIDS charities. So, I mean, maybe when, Will bites Stewart on the hand, maybe that's like a sexually transmitted thing. But again, like other themes, like other aspects, the movie doesn't go there far enough for me to totally buy it.
Yeah, I agree. And like again, there's that scene. And actually, I want to shout out this review again by Anoria Valamon at Medium. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. But she talks about this in her review. She says that like the AIDS crisis was kind of getting into its peak around that time, or maybe had already peaked in the early 90s. The Will character doesn't really care about that. Like he actually seems to be pretty homophobic. He thinks that, gay seniors, is a quote that he uses, are like one of the problems in society. So maybe we're supposed to like criticize Will for that and think that he's like a bad person from the start. But I don't think that that's what the movie is trying to say. So I feel like if it is trying to sort of recognize the AIDS crisis and like pay respect to that, it's very hypocritical to then have this protagonist who like says homophobic stuff like that,
Yeah. And it's not enough of a critique of that kind of person, the Will character, to land.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I, yeah, like again, this movie's all over the place. Like if it is trying to thematically make that point, there's no way to know that because the movie's not consistent enough to like really make that apparent, If I may, I would like to talk about the things that I like about the movie. So getting into the form and aesthetic of this movie, it is an extremely well-made movie, purely from its visual style, its soundtrack. You alluded to the editing, maybe not the editing so much, but I think this is more of a good-looking production than a lot of Hollywood productions nowadays. It's really beautifully lit. There are a lot of very careful like tracking shots and zooms that kind of show a lot of action happening simultaneously. I think a really good example of that is at Raymond Alden's party, where there's a lot going on and we kind of eavesdrop in a lot of different conversations at the same time. I really love the driving scenes, which are very clearly just like shot in a studio, like with a rear projection in the background. I love that look. I think you can have some like really incredible camera movements when people are supposedly driving in a car that you wouldn't be able to have if you were to like shoot it in an actual car while it's in motion. So I love those shots. I really did like the slow motion deer chase. I thought that was kind of a surprisingly beautiful moment.
Yeah.
There are a couple other like dissolves that I thought were really beautiful as well. There's one amazing shot where it transitions from the New York City skyline to kind of like a full moon. And I think that's a good way to combine the two sort of worlds that this movie is set in, And then lastly, Ennio Morricone's score again is just as exciting, suspenseful, grandiose as so many of his scores are. This movie looks and sounds amazing in a way that I wish more Hollywood movies would try to do nowadays,
I agree. I was immediately taken by the score and the scene where Jack Nicholson is running after that deer. I still don't know how they pulled that sequence off, because it's a real deer and seemingly Jack Nicholson is right behind it. I'm like, whoa, that's impressive. The beginning of this movie, when the Will character hits a wolf with his car, it's dark, it's late at night, he's all alone on a snowy road, and he walks up to this wolf that's apparently dead on the road. I thought this opening was so effective with the thrills, with the suspense, with everything I wanted out of the entire movie. And I jumped. When the wolf suddenly comes to life and bites Will on the hand, it got me. And then in the forest, you see the eyes light up of the other wolves, presumably other werewolves. And It was just a lot of danger in that scene, menace, and I loved it. That was great.
Yeah, totally. It's a great opening. I think like we have these great close-ups of like the wolf's eyes kind of like suddenly blinking open, you know? That's kind of paralleled later in the movie when James Spader is turning into a wolf, and we have this like, it's like a close-up, but it's from the side of him, but we still see like his suddenly golden eye, and like the music is like very mounting in suspense at that moment. There are a lot of individual stylish moments like that kind of carried my interest throughout the movie.
Right. That's the thing. Like, my interest was there just enough throughout because of some of the shots and the I mean that's where Nichols, I think, shined in this film, where how to use the camera, especially in the office building itself, that as a location, as a set, I found very impressive and ornate and just really beautiful. And the use of elevators in certain sequences was so cool. My eyes were like, whoa, 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 this is awesome.
Yeah, totally. I love that elevator shot that you're talking about. I think there's one where Stuart is seen like rising in an elevator in the background, and then suddenly there's a closer elevator that Will is in. So it's kind of like symbolizing, you know, how quickly they can like rise or fall in their line of work. Yeah, really great visual moment. Very, very interesting. Well done. Getting into the good, the bad, and the campy, is there any other good stuff that you want to bring up?
Yes. I, again, as a fan of Lon Chaney's Wolfman, and particularly the costume design of Lon Chaney's Wolfman, it really pleased me to see that echoed in Jack Nicholson's Wolfman, where he's very well dressed. He's wearing slacks and a button shirt, and it's tucked in. And there's even one sequence where Will runs into Central Park as a wolf wearing a blazer. I was like, man, this is a throwback to, again, Universal's Wolfman. And it looks as silly in the 90s as it does in the 40s.
I somehow didn't really pick up on that. I guess maybe because like sport coats and like button-up shirts seem like so much a part of Will, you know? Like, I don't even know what else he would wear. That's like his character to a T, you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's something about it.
Yeah.
That's it, actually. We've talked about all my other good stuff.
Okay, cool. I don't have a lot else here either. I do want to say that I was surprised how moved seems like too strong of a word, but I was engaged in like the relationship between Will and Laura. I think Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer are just too good of actors to like not really make that believable, you know? I think the Laura character does have some interesting elements to her. You know, she has this brother that committed suicide. She has this father who she seems to detest and is trying to sort of like rebel against him at every possible moment, you know? And I think the relationship between Will and Laura is very icy and cold at first, but then, you know, I do think that there is some believability to how they kind of break down each other's exteriors. And then at the end of the film, we have this weird relationship, which reminded me of another movie that we talked about on the podcast, Cat People, the remake from 1982, where it seems like maybe their relationship is going to work, even though at least one of them is like, you know, an animal human hybrid or like beast or whatever, you know? So there are these great moments at the end where it's like, you know, this weird sort of interspecies romance might actually work after all. It's just a bizarre theme. And I think, you know, again, Nicholson and Pfeiffer really kind of make it work in this movie against like the logic of the script. And like, you know, maybe it's also Mike Nichols too, because as you said before, he is able to work with actors very well and get fairly convincing dramatic performances out of them. So I thought that one element of the story worked pretty well.
So that's interesting. I'm ready to talk about some bad things as a counterpoint to that.
Okay.
And maybe you agree. I don't know. I found their chemistry non-existent. I really struggled believing that these two humans would actually spend this much time together, especially Michelle Pfeiffer, the Laura character. She has all these defenses, and I did not believe them to have been broken down by Will, who is not as charming as he thinks. And a lot of that's in the dialogue, too. I found the dialogue really forced and trying to be witty and charming and just not being for me. Like, there's a scene where, oh, this was so groan-worthy. When they first meet, Will trips and his hand touches or falls into Laura's breast. And he's like, oh, sorry, nothing to worry about here. I'm a married man. And she's like, okay. But me, Vincent, in the seat is like, what kind of line is that? It's not even delivered believably, or it was so awkward. And I thought that that was their entire relationship.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And that is a terrible scene, like maybe the worst part of the movie. And, you know, shortly before that, like, I think like, what is it? She gives him her drink and he doesn't finish it. And then she's like, oh, the last civilized man in the world because he didn't finish my drink. And it's like, really? That's like where you're going to like make that assessment off of? Like, your bar is way too low, Laura. Come on. So I agree with you. Like, yeah, that does not play very well. The Will character is like not charming for sure. I guess I'm maybe reading a lot into the Laura character. It's interesting to imagine her like only being with Will as like an act of vengeance against her father or whatever, which admittedly does not really make their like romance very believable. I do understand that. But it's almost like against her will, not to use a bad pun, but like she recognizes that Will is like not, maybe not a good person, not right for her, like not, you know, as charming as he thinks he is, like you said, but like almost against her will again, sorry. You know, she finds herself attracted to him, and maybe it is that like animal magnetism, you know?
Yeah, I understand where what you're saying. I think that that's the ideal version of this movie. I think that's where it wants to get to.
Yeah.
But the script or actors not being in a good mood that day, I don't know. Just it shoots itself in the foot.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that for sure. Yeah. I do like the ending, but like before then, I think there's a lot of their relationship that does not work.
One more thing I want to say about the shaman character. Oh, no. Well, it wasn't as campy as I think, again, it wanted to be. So it just came off kind of obligatory. But also my biggest problem with this movie is that I didn't get a sense of tragedy from Will. I got the sense that here's a man whose life is actually pretty good. He turns into a werewolf and then it gets better. And there was not enough sense of tragedy from him for me to be invested in any sort of stakes or conflict or drama. And so it was just like it was 2 hours of a man's life just getting better, which runs counter to what they teach you in, you know, story school.
Yeah. That's a great point. You're totally right. That's kind of one of my main criticisms of the movie too. Going back to like the Dionysian thing, not to rely on that too much, but I think if like the movie had really went full speed ahead into that territory and like Will kind of became this like totally amoral, really destructive, violent, awful, evil creature, but seemed to really enjoy it, and like maybe his life did get better, like despite like his total amorality, it probably would have been a more interesting movie, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, as it is, it kind of seems like it doesn't really know what it wants to say about his character.
Yeah. That's all I got.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I have too. I think like the werewolf stuff is pretty campy. The makeup again, surprisingly, is kind of, they just look sort of scruffy and they have those contact lenses and that's like all we get. So I put that in the campy category as well.
My campy thing is, I don't know if you noticed this, but Will gets bit by a werewolf at the beginning of the movie. And he's all bandaged. His hand has a bandage on it. The timeline of this movie is presumably a long time, and he never takes that bandage off his hand. He takes it off once to like inspect it, and it's fine, but he keeps it on the whole movie. And I found that really silly. Maybe like the continuity checker in the script didn't catch it. Like, wouldn't that be healed by now? He's a werewolf after all.
How long is it between full moons? Like several weeks, right? Like a month or so?
A month, yeah.
So, you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, this movie is taking place along or across numerous months. It's a little ridiculous. Yeah.
Also, when the shaman says, "Bite me," he wants to be bitten so he can live eternally. That, again, such an oddball moment that the tone was just so off for that. But it was arguably very campy. Jack Nicholson being like, "What? No, I'm not going to bite you, bro. Get away from me." And the infamous peeing on the shoes scene did have me laughing out loud. So good. That was a great moment.
Yeah, that is a good scene. Largely due to James Spader, I would say. I like him a lot in this movie. And like in general, I think James Spader knows how campy a werewolf movie should be, or like over the top, you know? And he like really like dives into his role, especially towards the end when he is turning into a werewolf. Yeah, so he's campy in the best way possible in this movie.
I agree. I think he is the strongest element of this film. He's just in a different movie.
For me, like the cinematography and the music are like the best parts in the movie, but James Spader is a close third, in my opinion.
Yeah.
All right. So here on Camp Kaiju, for anybody unfamiliar, we have four different ratings in our ranking system. The highest ranking, it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Our third ranking is, it may be historically significant or just fun, but does not stand the test of time. And our worst rating, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time.
I'll go first, and then I think you're going to end it on a slightly more positive note. This is a rare rating for me, actually. I think it does not stand the test of time. I think it doesn't offer anything truly engaging. I don't think it's historically significant. I don't think this is worth your time, everybody. I think it's a lot of fluff. And ultimately, you're just like, well, that was 120 minutes of just Jack Nicholson running around as a slightly hairier version of Jack Nicholson.
That is a perfect summation of this movie. That should have been like on the poster, you know? 120 minutes of Jack Nicholson, slightly hairier, running around. I would definitely see that movie for sure. You're right that I will be a little bit more positive. I'm going to say that this movie, I think it is kind of fun. I don't think it's historically significant, but I do think, again, it looks and sounds great. And I think it's kind of interesting to see Hollywood productions from the 90s that still really cared about visual style and really tried to sort of pay attention to like the art of cinema, you know? I know maybe that sounds over the top for a movie that's really not very good, but like, yeah, just like the cinematography and music really are worth watching and listening to in this movie. So for me, it does not stand the test of time, but I do think it is fun. So it gets our second worst rating for me.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nice.
But there are better werewolf movies out there. So maybe watch those.
There are worse, I'm sure. Like I don't hate this movie. I'm just not into it.
Well, you know, like sometimes hating a movie is almost preferable to just being like, yeah, I don't really care about it. Like, you know, at least if you hate something, you feel strongly about it. But if it's just like bland and you're just like, oh, whatever, I don't really care, then what's the point of watching it, you know? So, oh, by the way, before I wrap up with the outro, there's another really great werewolf movie from the early 2000s called Dog Soldiers.
I want to see it.
So good. Love it. It's British, Scottish, I think. I think it's by the director who made The Descent shortly after that, if I remember right. Anyway, Dog Soldiers, another fantastic werewolf movie. So check that one out.
Yeah, more werewolves on Camp Kaiju. I'm here for it.
Thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you hear, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com, Instagram, or Patreon for more monster movie content. We cannot thank you enough for listening and for sharing your thoughts and feedback. Before I forget, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com, hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. And as Camp Kaiju says, stay campy, friends. Until next time, thanks again.
Are you crazy? No. Oh. just marking my territory, and you got in the way. Sweet shoes, asparagus.